Okay, welcome everybody in the room here in Clifford Hall and virtually via Zoom to Lowi Tumi's public talk for his master's thesis master's thesis defense, multilayer analysis of in situ observations obtained from multiple field projects. And Logan started in the fall of 2020 with Mike Powell as the advisor, and Mike retired. He's from Millsville, and he will continue research as a PhD student in the fall at North Carolina Charlotte, doing something revolving around severe storms and convection, I believe. So, please put questions in the chat if you can. Otherwise, you can speak up at the end also. So with that, I'll give it to Logan to give us the presentation, and I will mute us here.
All right, thank you for that introduction, Dave, and thank you everyone else for being here. As Dave mentioned, a thesis is on melting layer observations from recent field projects. And to start off, just to cover what the melting layer is, it is the transition from ice to liquid phase, precipitation, and cloud system. So on the schematic on the right here, it just shows snow going through the melting layer and eventually becoming rain at the bottom. So to study the melting layer, most of the previous studies in the literature on the melting layer have been through remote sensing with radar observations or laboratory experiments and numerical models. So some of the limitations of these studies, though, is that radar observations rely on retrieval algorithms, which are verified with observations, and laboratory experiments don't necessarily always represent real clouds. And again, those could be verified with observations. And similarly with numerical models, if you can simulate the melting layer, but those also have to be verified by observations. And even microphysics parameterization schemes are going to be based on observations. So clearly observations are important, but relatively few studies have actually used in situ observations to study the melting layer because it's a bit difficult considering you have to usually have a field project and have to get the instruments and all that stuff necessary to actually directly measure clouds. But the benefit of these in situ observations is they can improve the representation of melting layer microphysics. So to start off, I'm going to cover some features of the melting layer. And the first is the radar bright band signal. So this is an vertical layer of enhanced radar reflectivity. It's shown in the black box on this figure, but the magnitude of that can be up to about 10 decibels of reflectivity, depending on the precipitation rate. So in this figure, we see time on the x-axis advancing towards the right and altitude on the y-axis. And you can see in the black box, the area of higher radar reflectivity associated with the melting layer. Now, there have been a few hypothesized contributing factors, and the first is the increase in dielectric constant of hydrometeors due to melting. However, more recently, this has been thought to not add up to the full magnitude of the radar bright band. So some other potential contributing factors include the non-sphericity or the shape of melting hydrometeors, and then enhanced aggregation and finally coupling of aggregation and the breakup. Now, I will say that enhanced aggregation seems to be the leading hypothesis for the strongest contributor to the bright band. And for anybody that's not familiar, aggregates are just ice and snow crystals that clump together during collisions to create large snow hydrometeors. And the next feature of the melting layer to cover is the isothermal layer, also called the quasi-isothermal layer because it's not necessarily exactly isothermal. But with this, melting causes diabatic cooling, which can create this isothermal layer, which ultimately can deepen the melting layer. But on the figure on the right here, it's a skew T log T plot of a diabatic cooling event due to melting, and there is in this red circle near 0 degrees Celsius isothermal layer created by melting. So on top of all that, the diabatic cooling itself, the forcing from that can produce mesoscale circulations and enhance frontogenesis. So it's an important feature considering the evolution of storms with that. And finally, the processes associated with this are important in forecasting surface precipitation type. There is actually a study from Canada in 2000 where they studied a case where melting induced cooling led to an unforecasted transition from rain to heavy wet snow. And because that was unforecasted and all the unexpected snow, there was a lot of societal impact from that. So it's important to have an accurate forecast with that. So moving on, I do want to summarize some of the findings from the previous in-situ studies of the melting layer. And the first main result of those is that large aggregates are the most common hydrometeor around the melting layer top at 0 degrees Celsius, and then aggregation is enhanced within the melting layer. And we can see this in the figure on the right. So it's showing concentration of large particles above 1.9 millimeters on the x-axis and altitude on the y-axis. I will point out the shaded region here is not exactly the melting layer, it's the isothermal layer in this particular case study. The melting layer would extend down to a lower altitude than that. But what we see is the concentration of large particles increases towards the top of the isothermal layer at 0 degrees Celsius. And then within the melting layer, there's an even larger concentration of these large particles until that subsides and the particles melt and they become smaller. So the concentration decreases. And also within this layer of enhanced aggregation, the concentration of small hydrometeors decreases due to the aggregation. So the next finding from previous studies is that relative humidity does influence the melting process. I realize there's a lot going on with this figure, but the point of it is to show how relative humidity influences melting. So what we have on the x-axis is relative humidity decreasing to the left and temperature increasing on the y-axis towards the bottom. And at lower relative humidity conditions, we can see that the snow, they're color-coded, but snow mostly mixed particles survive longer compared to higher relative humidity conditions. Or in other words, they survive to warmer temperatures is what I mean by longer. So I do want to point out an example. At 85% relative humidity, mixed particles survived only to about 6 degrees Celsius, whereas at 70% relative humidity, they found that mixed particles survive to warmer than 8 degrees Celsius even. And finally, relative humidity is not just important for how far snow melts before it, snow falls before it completely melts rather. It also impacts when the particles start to melt, because even in temperatures above 0 degrees Celsius in low relative humidity conditions, snow might sublimate instead of melting. And moving on, the next finding from previous studies is that melting causes an increase in hydrometeor area ratio. So what is area ratio? It just tells you basically how round a particle is, but I'll have more information on that calculation later. And from this figure on the right, it is essentially a vertical profile of the atmosphere shown in temperature. So colder temperatures at the top, warmer temperatures at the bottom of the y-axis. And on the x-axis is the diameter. That's going to be the diameter of the particles. And then colored is the area ratio. So higher area ratios are more round particles, while lower area ratio is less round particles. So typically above the melting layer and frozen particles, aggregates will have lower area ratios and rain will have higher area ratio. And we see that the area ratio increase is first noticeable in small particles, and then for larger particles, they take a longer time to fully melt, and then they will eventually become round. And the final finding is that melting modifies the particle size distribution. So again, there's a bit going on if you're unfamiliar with how particle size distributions work. So one way to actually look at the particle size distribution is to fit it to a specific function. So you can fit the size distribution, for example, to an exponential distribution or a gamma distribution. So what I have shown here from the study from Stewart et al. Is an inverse exponential distribution. So what this essentially is the function, it's the number of particles as a function of diameter is equal to n naught, which is the intercept parameter times e to the negative lambda d. And the lambda is the slope parameter. So with the intercept and slope parameter, those two parameters, you can use them to evaluate how they change within the melting layer and from that and for how the size distribution itself changes based on those parameters. So with this study, they found that the slope parameter decreases with decreasing altitude until around the top of the melting layer when it starts to increase towards the Marshall-Palmer rain distribution. Similarly, with the intercept parameter, that decreases with decreasing altitude, but it continues decreasing within the melting layer until around when melting ends and then starts to increase towards, again, the Marshall-Palmer distribution. So I will also point out one of the limitations of all these studies that I have shared is they tend to have a limited sample size, as in they just have either a few melting layer cases or sometimes just a single melting layer case. So that is where my thesis work starts to come in as I go to the objectives, which the main objective is just to broadly extend previous in situ analysis of the melting layer. And with that, we want to characterize the particle size distribution and area ratio within, from above, within, and below the melting layer, and also determine the impact of relative humidity on the general melting process and the melting layer. So to do so, we use direct observations from several recent NASA field campaigns, which their logos are shown on the right for people that are familiar with those, but they include a variety of environments and storm types. Now, how these objectives can help and how these observations can help is the determined relative humidity effects on the melting layer can be incorporated into something like numerical models to improve weather forecasts, and also understanding how the size distribution changes within the melting layer can improve rainfall estimates from radar observations. So for a little bit more background on the NASA field campaigns, I'm first going to cover the general overview of the field campaigns, and then we'll worry about the cloud and precipitation probes in a moment. But first off, we have the project, their year, season, and location. And just to give an overview, MC3E and IPEX are both studied deep moist convection in the springtime. MC3E in 2011, while IPEX was in 2014, and MC3E was also in Great Plains while the IPEX was towards the southeast US. GCPEX studied wintertime lake effect snow in the Georgian Bay in Canada in 2012, and OlympEX was in 2015, but I have an asterisk there because it did go technically until 2016, but all of our cases are from 2015 during that campaign and during the late fall period. But that was studying mixed phase clouds around Mount Olympus in Western Washington, that's Washington State. And finally, IMPACTS, the most recent of these field campaigns, which actually very recently had a 2022 run, but for the 2020 phase of that field campaign, they studied snow bands in the Northeast US during winter. Now for the probes, they are broken up into cloud and precipitation probes. Essentially, the cloud probes just measure smaller particles than the precipitation probe, which measures larger particles. We can see the HVPS-3 is the only precipitation probe used for this. And then the cloud probes, the earlier ones had the 2DC, which is the two-dimensional cloud probe. And then starting with IFEX, they switched to the 2DS, which is a newer probe. And it is shown on the left here is the 2DS, 2DC in the middle, and HVPS-3 on the far right. Now, I will point out there are more probes, but I'm not highlighting them because they aren't too relevant to the research here. But one thing you might notice with the 2DS is it has four total probe arms. It has actually two photodiode arrays. It has one horizontal positioning and one vertical, whereas we can see the 2DC only has one and the HVPS-3 only has one. And that's where with OlympEX and IMPACTS, the two HVPS-3 comes into play because the two HVPS3 probes were used to match both the horizontal and vertical orientation of the 2DS. Okay, so moving on, I have even more information about the imaging probes, and here's their full names without just the acronym. So the two-dimensional stereo probe has a 10 micron pixel resolution, but a smaller sample volume, while the high-volume precipitation spectrometer version 3, as the name implies, it has a larger sample volume, and it has a lower pixel resolution of 150 microns. And with this figure on the right, the main point of it is to show the different sizes that the two probes can measure, but it is the on the y-axis, the total concentration for each probe at the different diameters, just averaged throughout an entire flight. But with this, what you can see is the 2DS does measure smaller probes than the HVPS, while the HVPS measures larger particles than the 2DS. Now, to process the data, including, there's not just these imaging probes, we also have probes that measure like standard atmospheric variables, there's also GPS and things like that. So we do have information on temperature, relative humidity, including dew point temperature, pressure, altitude, and all that sort of stuff. But to process all that data, it's done with the Airborne Data Processing and Analysis Software Package, or ADPAA, and it also is processed with the NCAR system for optical array probe data analysis version 2, or SOTA 2, which processes the imaging probe data for the 2DS and HVPS 3. So, there we go. More information about the imaging probes and a schematic for how they work. We saw the probe arms earlier that I mentioned, so that is these parts extending out of the canister here, but within the canister, there's this laser beam that fires into the probe arm where there is a mirror that deflects the laser beam into the other probe arm where there happens to be another mirror that then deflects the laser beam to the photodetector array. So between the two probe arms is where this laser beam can be shadowed by a particle image as shown in the box here. And depending on what is shadowed is what eventually becomes the image. So in the photodetector array, it might be a little bit hard to see here, but it does show that particle becoming shadowed in the pink color here, I believe. And when that is shadowed, that eventually becomes the image. So if the pixel of the imaging array here is greater than 50% shadowed, that's when it does count as a pixel for a part of the hydrometeor image. And one more thing to point out with the hydrometeor image that we do end up getting, this is an example ice crystal image. The size is determined by what is called the fast circle method, which just fits the smallest possible circle around the image. And the resulting diameter is the diameter of the hydrometeor. But that fast circle diameter and area of the circle actually comes into play with area ratio, which, as I mentioned earlier, that is basically tells you how round a particle is because it's the ratio of the particle image, shown here as an example particle image, to the fast circle area. So the example image here is actually of both the 2DS and HVPS3 imaging the same particle. Because they are different resolution probes, they actually image the particle differently. This is an idealized spherical particle, just to point out. And it might be hard to see, but the HVPS 3 has a grid that is equal to 15 pixels of the 2DS grid. But the main point of showing this figure here is that low resolution probes, such as what we use with the HVPS 3, has lower area ratio for circular hydrometeors. So even though the fast circle area is larger for the HVPS 3, the image size is actually smaller than the 2DS. The HVPS3 is shown with the purple box and also includes the blue boxes here, but does not include a pixel like this one, which has blue but also white. So that would not count as shadowed for the HVPS3. And ultimately, the result is lower area ratio for higher resolution. Now, one more thing to point out with area ratio is the value for area ratio of a raindrop is expected to actually be different because one, raindrops are not perfectly spherical. And two, the images are usually stretched from the imaging probes, so that also contributes to area ratio not being exactly equal to one. We would typically expect for a range of it to be about 0.8. And the final thing to point out, since I've been going on with both the 2DS and HBPS-3, the analysis is only going to be done through the HBPS-3 because one thing we noticed with the lower sample volume of the 2DS is there would be a lot of zero counts. And with the 1 Hz data that we use, it wouldn't really provide useful information for the melting layer analysis. Okay, so next up, we do need to define what the melting layer depth is. And the top of the melting layer can be a little bit complicated because the top is not going to simply be defined as just 0 degrees Celsius air temperature. It's actually the 0 degrees Celsius ice fold isotherm. And at this location, we have, I mentioned earlier, typically aggregates, but frozen hydrometeors. You can see images of them in the HBPS-3 and 2DS here. But the reason it's not just a 0 degrees Celsius air temperature is because of the impact relative humidity has on the melting process. And in low relative humidity conditions, again, particles can sublimate even when the air temperature is above zero. So the 0 degrees Celsius ice bulb temperature is a better representation of the melting layer top because it accounts for one, the pressure, two, the temperature, and three, the relative humidity of the air, as well as the phase of the particle being an ice particle. So just for comparison, some past studies have used a wet bulb temperature for the melting layer top, but the ice bulb temperature does account for the phase. And then within the middle of the melting layer, that's where we just have mixed phase and partially melted hydrometeors as imaged here by the HBPS and 2DS again. And fortunately, the bottom of the melting layer is a lot simpler in that it's just when all hydrometeors are finally melted and all the images appear fully round. So one thing we need to do is actually calculate the ice bulb temperature. So that is going to be calculated with a bulb temp ADPA module. If anybody's interested in that, I can give them more information on it. But basically it inputs air temperature, dew point temperature, pressure, and uses a numerical solver to give the ice bulb temperature. And colored in these plots is the ice bulb temperature. Temperatures above 0 degrees Celsius are colored in red, while below are colored in blue. And the solid black line is going to be the 0 degrees Celsius ice bulb isotherm. We're of course interested in that because it's the melting layer top or the temperature at which particles would start to melt. And we also break that down for two pressure levels, 1000 millibars and 500 millibars. 500 millibars, of course, is at higher altitude and more typical of what we might see in the clouds that are studied. So with this, I do want to point out one location for 80% relative humidity, what air temperature we would need for hydrometeors to start melting. So at 80% relative humidity for 1000 millibars, you would need an air temperature of 1.1 degrees Celsius to get to a 0 degrees Celsius ice bulb temperature. Now compare that to 500 millibars, you would need a 1.8 degrees Celsius air temperature, and it requires a warmer air temperature because lower pressure or higher altitude will cause relative humidity to have a greater impact on the ice bulb temperature. All right, so with all that, we can finally go to what actually qualifies as a melting layer profile and all of the data. So first of all, for the criteria, it has to be a continuous vertical measurement of hydrometeors melting, and they have to be sampled during ascent or descent. And this is important because even though in the data and in the images, we might see a transition from frozen to liquid precipitation, if it's a level flight leg, the aircraft is traveling horizontally, that would probably be across a front where there's no vertical layer of melting. And then finally, we do have to define a threshold concentration for what is a cloud. And based on past literature and the data, we did 10 to the third number per meter to the fourth. So finally, getting to the plot on the right, there is a lot going on here, but I should point out all of our data is based on time because the probes measure in frequency So they take so many measurements over a period of time. So all the data is going to be time series like this, but what we're more interested in is the altitude change, and that's what's shown on the second y-axis on the right. So that gives us the depth of different features that we see in these plots. And then in this one, we have the air temperature in red and ice bulb temperature in green, and that is the top x-axis. And we see as the aircraft descends with this vertical profile that the air temperature does increase and increases towards what would be melting temperatures. And then to see if we're actually in cloud, that's when we look at the HVPS3 total concentration. And for this case, we are well above the minimum threshold. We're actually even above 10 to the sixth number per meter to the fourth. So this is an example of what a melting layer profile looks like. And then the final thing we do before I get into the results is divide the profiles and samples into two different types, either ramps or spirals. And this is the 3D flight that 3D path that the aircraft takes while it samples the melting layer. So shown in the solid blue line is just the 3D flight path. And then to actually see how that varies horizontally, because sometimes it can be hard to see, the dashed line is the surface projection of that. And then the red arrowhead is the direction. And just for reference, the X distance is going to be the longitudinal distance and the Y distance is latitudinal. And then the Z axis is altitude, so we can see the depth as well. And with these two types, on the left shown is a ramp and on the right shown is a spiral. So ramps are just straight flight paths as during an ascent or descent, while spirals turn and will spiral during the ascent or descent. And just to point out, on the left is a ramp ascent, on the right is a spiral descent. I also will point out that some previous studies have made a distinction between what's called Eulerian spirals and Lagrangian spirals, but because it is hard to actually make that distinction, especially with the relatively shallow layer of the melting layer, we decided to not make that distinction between them. Okay, so we can finally go through the results. And in total, we have a roughly even mixture of ramps and spirals. And we can see the relative humidity conditions also broken down here. A lot of our cases are high relative humidity or above 90% with 17 total. And then 7 additional cases are saturated, which just means 100% relative humidity within the full depth of the melting layer. And then finally, we do have 9 low relative humidity cases in total. So continuing on with the cases, that adds up to 33 total cases, and I unfortunately don't have time to present on all of them, so we will have to divide them into 5 different case types. So we have high relative humidity, saturated, enhanced aggregation case that I will present, and then low relative humidity, and finally one with an isothermal layer. And then you can see the labels that we use for the case. That's not too relevant, but just to point out what it means, it's the field project acronym at the start. And then it's for this one, it's a ramp descent. For example, this impacts one is a spiral. So that says PI and ascent would be ASC. And then we have the relative humidity tag on the end for the average relative humidity through the melting layer depth. So starting with the high relative humidity case, what this looks like. So this is similar to the temperature plot that I showed earlier, and then it's time series data, but we're mainly focused on the changes over the melting layer depth as if it's a just straight vertical profile of the melting layer. And then we have on the top x-axis now relative humidity to see how that varies throughout the melting layer. And finally, on the bottom x-axis is the measurements based on diameter from the HVPS3 probe. On the left is going to be the concentration colored, and on the right colored is area ratio. So with all that, the first thing to cover is the concentration. And before I actually cover that, I do want to mention that the horizontal lines, those are important. So the solid black line is the 0 degrees Celsius air temperature. And in this case, that is the same as the ice bulb temperature. So they share the same line, but when they do not share the same line or are not at the same altitude, the ice bulb temperature will have a dotted line. And finally, the bottom of the melting layer is shown with the dashed line. Okay, so back to the actual changes here. We have the concentration of large particles decreases and the maximum diameter also decreases within the melting layer. And then for particles above the melting layer that are around 1,000 to 2,000 microns or so, their concentration decreases within the melting layer, while the concentration of smaller particles below 1,000 microns increases. Now, looking at area ratio, again, smaller area ratios are for frozen hydrometers above the, typically above the melting layer, and then the larger area ratios are raindrops. So what we see is that area ratio does increase for the hydrometeors. It's first noticeable in the small hydrometeors, and then the larger hydrometeors are the last ones to fully melt. And just for reference, the values that we see here, the area ratio increases from about 0.5 to 0.8 or even up to 0.9 in this case. And then we did fit the spectrum to an exponential fit, and we're going to look at the parameters that I mentioned in the introduction. So these plots, once again, are similar, but on the bottom, we're now looking for the left plot at slope parameter, and then on the right plot is the intercept parameter. So what we see with both of these is that they're actually smallest above the melting layer, and then they increase within the melting layer, at least as melting begins, and then slowly increase within the melting layer and below. Also, we'll point out that the intercept parameter is a little bit spiky with this data. There's a lot of variability there because it's really sensitive to changes in concentration. But with these, both of them increase as melting begins, and that is due to the concentration of large particles decreasing mainly, and the shift of concentration to smaller particles. And finally, the most significant changes are near the melting layer top right when melting begins. Moving on to the saturated case, this is pretty similar to the high relative humidity case, but there is one thing of interest that I will get to that is different, but we do see the decrease in maximum diameter for this case. We also see the area ratio of large particles increases, but one thing you might notice that's a bit peculiar is the area ratio increases, first noticeable with small particles, but it's above the melting layer top. So one thing that is a question is why that happens, why it's above the melting layer top. And there are a few possibilities, but it most likely boils down to uncertainties in the measurements from the instruments, because the instruments, unfortunately, are not perfect, and they do have some uncertainties, like the temperature probes have uncertainties in the temperature range. So really, instead of having an exact altitude of the melting layer top, it's more of a range. This just happens to be in the data when the temperature probe first measured the 0 degrees Celsius, both air temperature and ice bulb temperature in this case, because it's saturated, but it likely does boil down to uncertainties in the instruments. And we do see the same in two other cases, just to point out. But otherwise, for the most part, in all the other cases, all the other 30 cases, the area ratio increases below the melting layer top. And then just to briefly look at the exponential fit parameters with this case to compare it to the previous one, we do see that both the parameters are lowest above the melting layer top. They have the most significant change at around the melting layer top when melting begins, but what we will really see is there's three or four even distinct spikes in the both parameters, and these are associated with small increases in the hydrometeor concentration. So if I go back to the previous slide, we do see a little bit of variability in the concentration, and this really shows us that the parameters are very sensitive to even relatively small changes in concentration. But if we still look at the overall trends of how the parameters change from above to within and below the melting layer, it's pretty similar to the high relative humidity case overall. Moving on to the cases with more significant aggregation, this is what it looks like. And I think it's obviously noticeable that the maximum diameter increases within the melting layer, especially compared to the previous cases where it more steadily decreased within the melting layer. And in this particular case, from impacts with about 94% average relative humidity, just to point out, there's roughly a 300 meter depth of greater concentration of large particles and greater maximum diameter. Now, something that is odd is that the concentration of small particles also increases in this location, and that might be because the particles are coming from even smaller sizes than the HVPS3 can measure. And the final thing to point out with this is we do see the area ratio increase, again, starting with smaller hydrometeors, then finally with larger hydrometeors, but the location of that is at the same location where maximum diameter starts to decrease. And then just to briefly look at the next significant aggregation case, this one also has a large increase in maximum diameter, but compared to the previous case, the concentration of smaller particles measured by the HVPS3 does decrease. So those are likely aggregating into the larger particles. And also just like the previous one below the melting layer top, which is now the dotted line because it is no longer saturated. And yeah, that's the dotted line for the melting layer top. The area ratio increases after that as maximum diameter starts to decrease again. So finally, I do have the low relative humidity case, and I already pointed out the dotted line is the melting layer top for these. And what we see with concentration is just concentration decreases even above the melting layer top due to sublimation and within the melting layer and even a little bit below the melting layer because we're subsaturated and losing particle mass overall. And for area ratio, just like with the high relative humidity cases, that does increase first with the small particles and then finally with the large particles. And then for the exponential fit parameters, how do they change with relative humidity? So with the low relative humidity above the melting layer top, they do become minimized, both of them. And then when the melting begins and maximum diameter decreases, both of them sharply increase. And then from within the melting layer to below on both of those, it's a little bit more variable, but we still see the trend of the biggest increase happening when we see maximum diameter decrease. And then one more case to share is just what a quasi-isothermal layer looks like in the data. And we see that temperature with altitude does not really change all that much. There is some fluctuation and variability, but the main point of showing this is just to talk that there weren't that many cases with an actually isothermal layer. There was one additional case, but that isothermal layer was actually solely above the melting layer, so it was not due to melting. I also forgot I had a circle, so there's the isothermal layer circle. And then to summarize the results, there is once again a lot going on here, but these two bar graphs show basically the trends of what happens to the individual parameters that we've looked at, concentration, area ratio, maximum diameter, and then the intercept and slope parameter from the exponential fit. And the top bar graphs are for the transition above to within the melting layer. So generally the upper portions of the melting layer, and the bottom one is from within to below the melting layer or the lower portions of the melting layer. And then for each of these, we can have a decrease, which is on the bottom in red, equal is in middle and green, blue is an increase at the top. And then if there is no data, that is going to be in gray. And finally, for concentration and area ratio, we divide those into small particles and large particles. The cutoff point for those is 1,000 microns. So above that's large and below that's small particles. So to highlight this from left to right, we will first look at concentration. And what we see is a decrease in both large and small particles from above to within the melting layer as the most common result. But for large particles, they also stay equal in a good number of the cases. Now, something that is not shown is how this relates to relative humidity, because this is with all of the cases, regardless of the relative humidity conditions. So I will point out that the concentration decrease for both within to below and above to within the melting layer is more frequent with low relative humidity conditions. And the final thing to point out is from within to below the melting layer, typically concentration stays the same. We usually see the transition of either an increase or decrease from above to within the melting layer or the upper portions. Next, for area ratio, this is probably the biggest trend in the entire data set, is that area ratio of the particles increases early in the melting process. This is true for both small and large particles, but sometimes large particles, especially again in lower relative humidity conditions, that takes longer for them to increase, and that transition would be from within to below the melting layer. And because the area ratio increases from in the upper portions, it usually will stay the same. And the lower portions, also now is a good time to point out where we have no data. You might notice that that is more frequent with large diameters, with larger particles, because sometimes there's enough evaporation and sublimation that we don't have large particles to actually transition from within to below the melting layer. All right, next result is that maximum diameter does decrease. And from above to within the melting layer, we sometimes see it increase or stay equal, as in there's no change. And those are likely a result of enhanced aggregation, but still in most of the cases, we do see a decrease in the maximum diameter. I will point out once again with low relative humidity conditions, that's typically when we're more likely to actually see an increase or enhanced aggregation of the melting layer. And then from within to below the melting layer, there's still often a decrease, and next most likely would be no change in the maximum diameter. And overall, from above the melting layer to below the melting layer, there is going to be a decrease, because typically if it increases within the melting layer, it will subsequently decrease below the melting layer. And then the final things to look at are the exponential fit parameters. So with this, there is a lot of variability in these parameters. I've talked about this a lot in the results, but they're really sensitive to changes in concentration. So this is especially true when we look at the intercept parameter. Overall, it does more frequently increase from above to within the melting layer than either staying the same or decreasing. But for both parameters, actually, if we look at the transition within to below the melting layer, there's roughly the same amount of increases, decreases, or no changes. And then finally, the biggest signal that we do get, even with the variability, is an increase in the slope parameter from above to within the melting layer. Now, this is likely a result of either a decrease in maximum diameter can cause that increase, or an increase in concentration of small particles. But I will point out that's not likely. We did not really see that in the data, because in most of our cases, the concentration of small particles actually decreased, but it could also be a contributing factor, could be the decrease in concentration of large particles. Okay, so finally, I will keep that graph up on the right for reference, but just some concluding points from all of the results of the study. So first off, an increase in area ratio over a depth indicates melting is occurring. And you might be wondering why you can't just say an area ratio of, say, 0.8 indicates that all particles are melted. And the reason is because the area ratios did vary. I know I didn't show this too much in the cases that I presented, but in some of them, the area ratio of frozen hydrometers might be larger, or even the area ratio of the particles below the melting layer could also be lower. So overall, we have to look for the increase in area ratio to indicate melting is occurring. And finally, with area ratio, the increase was seen below the 0 degrees Celsius ice bulb isotherm, which does confirm that that is an accurate representation of the melting layer top and results from the Heimsfield et al. 2021 study. The next concluding point is that the concentration of both small and large particles decreases. And this is maybe something you could expect in low relative humidity conditions due to, again, evaporation and sublimation. But this also happens in high relative humidity conditions and even when the environment is saturated. So if there's 100% relative humidity and the concentration of large particles decreases, you would expect by conservation of mass that the small particle concentration would have to increase to have the same mass both above and below the melting layer. But we did not see that in the data. And that's where we get to one of the limitations is we don't exactly know what happened to particles that are smaller than 500 microns, because that is the low point for our measurements with the HVPS3. Finally, we have a few cases that have enhanced aggregation. While we did see only a couple of significantly enhanced aggregation, there were a few more cases that had enhanced aggregation, but typically the increase in maximum diameter would only be roughly 1 to 2,000 microns. And then the last concluding point is going to be on the quasi-isothermal layer, where we only saw 2 out of 33 cases have that feature. So moving on to future work, and on the note of the quasi-isothermal layer, one remaining question is, how is the lapse rate impacted? That is an avenue for future work to see. Instead of just if a 0°C vertical layer develops, if the lapse rate is perhaps lowered, because a lower lapse rate would still deepen the melting layer, that'd still be a sign of diabatic cooling, and that would better match results of previous studies. And then another remaining question in area for future work is how radar reflectivity changes in the melting layer compared to our observed particle spectrum changes. So this study was, of course, on the in situ observations of the particle spectrum, but it would be interesting to see how radar reflectivity changes, because that goes back to the bright band signal. And again, one of the leading hypotheses for the largest contributor to the bright band is enhanced aggregation, and you could compare cases where there is a bright band to changes in our particle spectrum to see if there's any signal there. And then finally, we again don't know what happens to hydrometers smaller than 500 microns. So there's not really much we can do with the data we have to look at what happens to those, but future field campaigns could consider newer probes that have a larger sample volume than the 2DS, but higher resolution than the HVPS3. I believe there is an HVPS version 4 in development that could be useful for future field campaigns, or I think there's a 50 micron channel of the 2DS, a probe with a 50 micron channel that could also be useful. So finally, with all that, I do have to give some acknowledgments. First of all, I do want to thank everybody for being here with the talk, but I do have to give special thanks as well to my committee members, Dr. Dave Deline for being my advisor, and first of all, actually, Dr. Mike Pellett for initially being my advisor and getting me situated with the grad school, especially that was during COVID times as well. So really appreciative to him for all the help with that and getting me started on the project. And then Dave for taking me in after Mike's retirement and helping me get the thesis and all this presentation, all that stuff done. And finally, Dr. Andy Heimsfield from NCAR for being on my committee and being very helpful with the project and helping with the progression throughout the research. And next is the entire department, really, of the UND Atmospheric Sciences, including faculty members, even outside of my committee and the classes. I've really enjoyed some of the classes there and learned a lot. Some of it's been helpful even with my thesis. And finally, can lump these three into one, but students, friends, and colleagues have all been helpful and have made the experience at UND very fun and memorable part of my life. And finally, the people you all do not see, but my family do have to give thanks to them. And then my references, and I'm open to any questions.
Thank you, Morgan. Up here.
Yeah, good job. Nice, Murph.
I'll start. Questions, you can put them in a chat, or you can ask, but if you stone in a room here.
Yes. Sure. Why did you use an exponential distribution over a gamma distribution or some other type of distribution?
One reason is that it only has two parameters. It only has the slope parameter and intercept parameter. So I believe some previous studies have even mentioned this, but it's easier to see changes in those parameters compared to, for example, a gamma distribution would be another one. And that's actually a good point and avenue for potential future work is looking at changes in a gamma distribution, because I know previous studies have looked at that as well.
Another question. I guess this may be a bit out of scope. I'm just curious if you saw anything. I'm not sure if you had any turbulence instruments on these airplanes, but did you notice any possible effects due to turbulence, I guess, near the top of the melting layer, or is that a bit out of scope? Or I guess even near like the boundaries of the cloud?
Yeah, I haven't looked at that.
Okay.
Yeah, I don't know if I've noticed anything that would be like effects of that. There is, while we'd like to think really it's a perfect like vertical profile of the atmosphere, as I showed with the flight path, there is some horizontal variation that might come into play as well, though.
How much horizontal variation was there you noticed along the flight path? I guess along any level flights that occurred or level sections of the flight, was there much horizontal variability in relative for saturation and temperature?
I would say it depends on the field campaign, really. I didn't go into too much detail on this, but if I go back to the list of field campaigns, for example, MC3 and IFEX, those two were studying deep convection, so there was more horizontal variability in those due to likely entrainment and things like that that you see with deep convection compared to something like Olympics had a more, I think, stratiform precipitation, so there wasn't as much horizontal variability that I at least saw in the data.
Okay. And then I guess one last question I have is, can you go back to your bar charts you had where you noticed the increases, red and green, those ones, yeah.
This one.
What was considered the limit of above and within?
Oh, okay. Yeah, so above the melting layer, we looked at roughly in the data, 60-second period above the melting layer, but for within, it was typically the top half of the melting layer, but we were looking for a transition. So like if there was an increase in, say, something like concentration of small particles, and then that was followed within the melting layer by a decrease, that would be two distinct transitions like that. Versus sometimes there would be like a decrease pretty consistently from all the way above to below the melting layer.
Thank you.
So other questions from here?
Yeah, we talked about this briefly yesterday, Logan. Looking at the ice content at the top end melting layer and condensed water content would be interesting for the impacts cases, how that varies through the melting layer depth.
Yeah, it would be interesting to see. You mentioned condensed water content.
Yeah, from Whisper.
Okay. Whisper, okay. Yeah, I'm not too familiar with that probe, but yeah, it would be interesting to see, I think, ice water content above the melting layer and see how that transitions within.
And also the humidity profile for the melting layer would be interesting.
Yeah.
The actual profile in the sublimating cases versus those at high humidity.
Yeah, we did look at how the relative humidity varied in like this case, for example, but seeing that like with the ice water content.
So did you see?
I'm looking at it from the. Go ahead, Dave.
I was just wondering about, you have relative humidity on this plot for the low relative humidity case. Can you say something about the relative humidity and its changes? Because you have them at least on these plots.
I haven't looked too much into that. I'm going to see if I have one case. There's been a couple cases, I think, where I've noticed certain trends in relative humidity. This would be one where in the location of enhanced aggregation, there was actually also a peak in relative humidity, but from an overall perspective, I haven't looked at that all too much. But yeah, I did find a couple, and this is one I distinctly remember because it followed the same path as that with the local maximum and both the maximum diameter and relative humidity in that layer.
Silly question, is this relative humidity with respect to water or ice? Or?
Yes, it's with respect to water.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Other questions? I don't see any questions in the chat. So anybody want to speak up? That's fine.
Just a comment, and I would like to see this work published because it's really good.
I'd like to publish it.
We've been talking about that, so we just got to keep Logan focused on continuing to do this a little bit when he has starts his PhD and see if we can get this published here. Because this is unique to look at so many cases for this. Other questions, anybody else online or anybody in the room here? I see no one's here, must have been a career.
Just one other thing, Frederick Fabre and McGill has looked at radar of the melting layer case of the melting layer. You may want to look at that to see if you have any ideas that you can do with the aircraft data.
Yeah, I definitely think that would be interesting, especially considering I mentioned the radar brightband, how that might compare to our changes in the spectrum. And yeah, really see how that compares.
Okay, well, I guess if there's no questions, thank Logan again.
Oh, you bet.
And then Andy and Mike and Logan and I will stay on, and the rest of you can leave. And then why don't we take a 5-minute break here or a 3-minute break, and then we'll come back, okay?
Sounds good.
All right. I will be back in a couple minutes.